Meeting will come to order. Members, if I had known what the weather was going to be like, the temperature this morning, I would have canceled this meeting. And, Oh, God, I apologize for dragging you out on a cold winter. I don't know if you saw, my wife was telling me that the Duluth, some Duluth reporter made national news by taking a cup of water and stepping outside like two nights ago and throwing it up in the air, and apparently by the time it hit the ground, some of it had crystallized. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah. So I actually went outside this morning to do it. It didn't work. That's right. Yeah, that's the test. Is that right? Really? Oh, okay.
Oh, does he?
Does he really? Oh, I'll have to try that.
Oh.
Oh, gosh. Representative Depke, would you be so fine, be so good as to make a motion to adopt the minutes of our January 13th Senate meeting?
Aren't we all?
Minutes are in your packet.
Mr. Chair, do you want to dabble us into a little more?
Yeah, I might just.
Like,
they're really bad. Might just do that. Representative
Depke. Yes. Chairman Mariani, I move to adopt the minutes of the January 13th meeting.
Thank you. Representative Depke moves adoption of the January 13th minutes. All in favor, or any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Duffy. Thank you, members. Today's agenda should be in your packet. Again, this will be part of our series of background information time in terms of sort of big, broad issues that can help guide our work and just general information that we need to know as K-12 policymakers in the Minnesota House. Members, outside of the work that we do in Representative Griley's committee, which is to properly resource our K-12 schools, I can't think of too many things more important that we do as a state legislature than to establish and update and monitor the state standards that guide the work of our K-12 schools and establishes broad policy expectations of that system and of our young people. And many of you, as you know, from your readings and interactions with others, understand the increasing importance of high quality outcomes and high expectations of our K-12 system in regards to every aspect of our social and economic life in the state of Minnesota. So this is vitally important work, and for the years that I've been here, we've had some incredible battles, some incredible, a lot of focus, a lot of shifting, changing directions, but generally speaking, pretty good common agreement across most of the ideological spectrum of the importance of making sure that our state, in fact, has clear and strong K-12 education standards. So there's no way, members, that we're going to do justice to this discussion in one hearing, but the intent today basically is to provide ourselves with just a broad look at what our standards framework looks like in our state, and then to have some discussions about different ways in which we go about assessing progress to those standards. And frankly, members, I think most of our battles, if you will, tend to fall more in the assessment area than the actual nature of our standards. So with that, what we're going to do, if you look at the agenda, we're going to start off with a broad presentation, depiction of NCLB, the No Child Left Behind Act, in regards to our standards. We'll then hear from Beth Awney with the Minnesota Department of Education. If you haven't met Beth, members, I encourage you to do that. She's a fine, good professional who's been doing this work for a number of years. She'll do a brief overview, a presentation of the framework of our standards. I think you'll find it to be a very helpful presentation. We'll then have a perspective from a local school district, St. Paul Public Schools, in terms of in terms of assessment. So how does this particular school go about, or district go about, doing these assessments related to standards and anything else they want to share in terms of the impact of assessments and standards on their ability to deliver quality instruction. And then we're going to shift a little bit over to Representative Brainerd. We held you over from the other day, but this kind of actually, you know, is a better fit, I think. To begin to talk a little bit more about different ways in which we assess our schools. I hope that we develop a good understanding of both the overlap but also the distinctiveness of attempting to assess schools as opposed to attempting to assess students. So Representative Brainerd is going to talk a little bit about the growth model concept. She'll be joined by Mr. Boltman from the Department of Education, who will then explain the growth model that was implemented by the department, I think in November, mid-November. And then we'll wrap up our discussion with my good friend Sal Kaur from the Edina Public Schools, who will then speak about this notion of multiple measures of student achievement within the framework of attempting to assess school and student performance. So I hope we'll try to move very quickly. I'll say that to the presenters because they would like to have some opportunities for members to raise questions. Just raise your hand. We'll take notes, and I may interrupt members or presenters to get your questions in. So with that, Ms. Larson, I think we're going to start with you. And again, we'll be moving quick, members, so don't feel offended if I push anyone as we go forward. Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, members, what I'd like to do in the very few minutes is talk about some of the salient aspects of the federal No Child Left Behind Act in the context of the topics that you are going to look at today as listed on your agenda. I suspect all of you are familiar with the No Child Left Behind Act in many facets, and so my hope today is to simply cover some of the ones that I think have a direct impact on the discussion and on our standards and assessment system that we have in state law today. Like IDEA, this federal law has significant financial and policy implications for Minnesota. Minnesota received over $111 million in fiscal year 2008 in Title I funding. Title I funding is distributed based upon the number of low-income families residing in a school district, and it is used to provide additional educational programs and services to help children who are behind in school. In addition, federal testing and reporting requirements pervade Chapter 120B of our state statute. That chapter governs statewide educational accountability. It is important to understand that the obligation to comply with this federal law does not prevent the state from implementing additional state education accountability measures if that is the intent of this body. Federal goals under this law impose both state and local requirements. In 2001, Congress reauthorized the Elementary and Secondary Education Act in order to give all children a fair, equal, and significant opportunity to obtain a high-quality education and reach proficiency on state standards and assessments. In order to affect this goal, states were required to align academic content with student performance standards and to annually assess students' progress in achieving those standards. In addition, schools, school districts, and the state were required to show that all students in the school were making adequate yearly progress so that 100% of students demonstrate reading and math proficiency by the 2013-2014 school year. As you are aware, I suspect, Congress has postponed the scheduled reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind Act, and quite a number of important people, including Senator Edward Kennedy, have weighed in on what it might look like and when this reauthorization might occur. The federal law changed notions of educational accountability. Historically, school districts developed local school accountability measures while implementing federal and state education requirements. These local measures were preempted by the federal law, which prescribed school and district level accountability measures and timelines for implementing those measures. The federal law increased state testing requirements and imposed progressively severe consequences on schools that failed to improve test scores. Among other things, the state must, or did, develop science content standards and science assessments in 3 grade spans, administer annual reading and math tests to all students in grades 3 through 8 and high school, require a sample of 4th and 8th graders to periodically take the National Assessment of Educational Performance, NAEP, annually assess limited English proficiency students, make available annual information on student performance and teacher qualifications, and show gains in academic achievement for all students and for specific student populations, to measure those gains against the state's definition of adequate yearly progress. The law has both strengths and weaknesses. The law has been applauded as a means for increasing the achievement of all students, including students who were historically disadvantaged. It has been criticized, among other reasons, because of the statistical differences that resulted in significant state variations in the proportion of schools demonstrating academic progress. And if I can digress for just a second, the reason for NAEP is essentially that, because every state has a different definition of what constitutes a proficiency, and also there are variations in statistical means by which that proficiency is measured. So NAEP was the way that the federal government would ensure some kind of means to compare across states the actual performance state by state. Under the federal law, states must use annual reading and math test data to demonstrate adequate yearly progress. All students and specific student populations, and this is based on characteristics such as race and ethnicity, economic disadvantage, language proficiency, and disability, must demonstrate adequate yearly progress. To comply with the federal law, states must use school-wide averages of student performance to measure progress toward having all students proficient by 2013-2014. However, the law allows each state to develop its own academic standards, use state-developed tests to assess students' mastery of those standards, and define what is proficient on state tests. The percent of students failing to make adequate yearly progress varies significantly by state due to statistical differences and other factors such as the content and rigor of state academic standards and the test scores that students must earn to be proficient. This has led some to debate the usefulness of having adequate yearly progress define success or having adequate yearly progress serve as the single measure of success.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Blackson. Very concisely done. And a couple of things that, for me, jumps out that I want to emphasize, re-emphasize, is that, in terms of the concepts that you presented, is that we're working within a framework that there's a national expectation, right? There's a national, not a national standard, but there's a national expectation that is reinforced by our ability to, therefore, then get Title I money. A quarter of $1 billion in our biennial activities is not an insignificant leverage that the federal government has. Nonetheless, they are our own standards, they are our own tests, and we also determine what the proficiency level is. The interesting thing, and it'll be interesting to hear from some of you later whether or not you've had these kind of interactions with your federal representatives, but The interesting thing for me is that this is setting up some thinking, at least, that I've heard in D.C., that, you know, if we're going to have this big national expectation and we have 50 different standards and 50 different proficiency levels and 50 different tests that are measuring that proficiency across the nation, then perhaps we ought to have one test, which of course implies that perhaps we ought to have one standard, which, you know, speaks to a national standard, which, as some of you know, other nations do. It's not something that Americans do. I mean, there is kind of a deep cultural thing here about, you know, each state, you know, having, you know, its right to determine, you know, what should be coming out of its K-12 system. And so I think there's this tension that's continuing to evolve between the national government and states in this regard. And I think it's important for us to pay really close attention and be in tight communication with our federal delegation with D.C. On this issue. I think there's lots of pros and cons in terms of talking about a national test and national standards. I frankly could think of a lot of cons, but it's a evolving debate. I think the other thing, Ms. Larson, that I just want to emphasize as well is that that there's nothing inside the NCLB dominated framework that says that any state cannot develop measures over and above those that are required to meet the NCLB expectations. And that goes to the heart of some of the issues we hear today, including some of Representative Brainard's, I suspect, discussion. So why don't we move on to the Minnesota Department of Education to have an overview then of our K-12 academic standards. And Ms. Beth Ani, good morning. Good to see you. Welcome to the committee. And, of course, you'll need to state your name for the record, and then it's your show.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Beth Ani. I'm Director of Academic Standards and T16 Initiatives for the Department of Education. And I've been asked to give a very quick overview of our academic standards and the revision process that we use for our standards. So we'll take a few minutes to look at, first of all, what's the purpose of the academic standards. By law, the purpose is to identify the statewide academic expectations for students, the kinds of academic content that are to be mastered in 5 subject areas, and that would be language arts, mathematics, science, social studies, and the arts. And then secondly, to define the statewide graduation requirements. So if 3 credits of mathematics are required, what constitutes the content that's in those 3 credits? We have some definitions that we work with in our standards development process. One is just the definition of a standard, and there are many different kinds of definitions of the word standard. One that we find very workable is that it's a general goal of student learning in a particular content area. So it's the goal of student learning. A benchmark, on the other hand, is a much more specific statement. It's specific academic knowledge and skills that schools must offer and students should acquire by the end of that grade level or grade band. Some of our standards go across multiple grade levels and can be achieved or must be achieved by the end of the grade band as opposed to the end of the grade level. A second purpose for benchmarks is to inform and guide parents, teachers, and schools and others, and for use in the development of our statewide tests. We have a cycle that's set in statute for the revision of our academic standards. The very first subject out of the gate to be revised was mathematics, and we did that revision in the 2006-2007 school year. And then those standards go through the rulemaking process. That whole process is complete now for mathematics, so we now have newly revised math standards that are in place in terms of at the state level, that they are formalized. They must be implemented by all schools no later than the 2010-2011 school year. And then they'll be revised again in 2015-2016. So this is the schedule, basically, for all of the subjects that the legislature has set in place, okay, for the five main subject areas for which we have state standards. Subjects that we don't have state standards in are health and phy-ed, world languages, and career and technical education. And school districts, by law, are required to revise those standards on a locally determined timetable. So they write their own standards or they adopt them from another source. Locally, they determine the standards in those areas and then the revision cycle.
Ms. Onik, just a quick question. In terms of the revision cycle, is that, I should know this, but I don't. Is that cycle determined by statute, or is that determined by, what determines the cycle of revision?
It's determined by statute.
It is.
Minnesota Statute 120B-023.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Another thing that's required by statute for our standards revision is that we must make sure every time we review the standards in a subject area that we include technology and information literacy skills. And we do this in consultation with school media specialists. Their premier document, the memo standards, is used as a foundational document for us every time we revise the standards in a subject area. A second factor we look at is college and work readiness skills. So all of our standards must reflect the kinds of knowledge and skills our students will need in order to be considered college and work ready for the future. And that's been a very, very challenging task. And as a result, Minnesota has participated in ACHIEVE's American Diploma Project in mathematics and language arts. So there we've had some national kinds of support in figuring out what the college and work readiness skills are that our students will need in order to be proficient in those two subject areas for the future. Third, we are required to consider the contributions of Minnesota American Indian tribes and communities for every subject that we revise. So that has been another challenge for our committees when they revise the standards.
Ms. Sonia, we do have a question from Representative Brannion. Representative Brannion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Onik, I'm wondering if you would comment on, and I don't want to derail the whole discussion, but my question is, having come through the mathematics revision, is your experience that our timeline is overly optimistic in terms of what we're trying to, the revision cycle, is it realistic in terms of a solid standards process, or ought we to look at that timeline more carefully?
Ms. Bonnie.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my opinion is that it is a realistic timeline for the revision of standards. And when I say that, it's with the caveat that we do have sufficient professional development and structures in place to make sure that the revised standards get implemented with integrity. But the process put in place, one subject per year, seems to work pretty well.
Thank you. Representative Abler has
just
a question.
Short. I know you're pressed for time.
No, it's quite all right.
Okay, and thanks for coming in. This whole thing about revision, I was talking to my school district, and we're pretty big, and every time there's another tweak, they have to factor it through 40,000 kids, and they have to spend $1 million or more to buy some books. Do you take that into consideration, too, especially now in a lean year when maybe there's going to be lesser money? Do you consider the economic realities and just the practicalities of adding a few good ideas to the standards?
Ms. Bonnie.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do. And this is a very hard issue that the committee always needs to deal with. You weigh the cost considerations of new materials and resources for our students versus what they need. What, you know, for 21st century kinds of skills and knowledge, you know, what do our students need, regardless of the resources? But if you look at the resources, which are a very, very important reality, what's the right balance to strike there? So So many times our standards committees need to rely on surveys of districts. What are your materials now? What are your resources? If we had this kind of thing put in place in mathematics, the most obvious example was grade 8 algebra, all students finishing algebra by the end of grade 8. If we did that, how difficult would it be to get the resources to help you to do that, including appropriate professional development? So that is always a very big consideration. But I have to say, I encourage the committee to not to be so tied to the present state of resources that we don't develop very forward-thinking strategy or standards.
Excellent question, Representative Abler. We do, I think all of us here, you know, sometimes in, you know, from our school districts in this regard, I suspect as we move forward, we'll hear some of that. But what I am hearing from Ms. Sawney is that the department is not oblivious to that and interacts with school districts in terms of trying to strike a balance in terms of, you know, the benefit related to the cost in this regard. Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Onyx, could you just quickly tell me, or give me an example of contribution of Minnesota American Indian tribes and communities, just so that I understand?
Ms. Onyx.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. One example, we dealt with this especially in the art standards, which were revised right after the mathematics standards. In the art standards, students are required to consider the contributions of Minnesota American Indian tribes and communities as they consider the artistic process. So how does create, respond, critique, how do those essential artistic processes, how do they play out when you consider just the Minnesota Native American community contribution to that? So that would be one example.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Duffy. Ms. Onyx, proceed. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Onyx. Representative Dietrich has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to continue the questioning that Representative Abler brought up, and I know that there have been certain people within our school district that have said, you know, one of the best things that you can do for us in these very difficult economic times is to delay the implementation of some of the standards. And they have one person, so I don't want to make a statement for the whole school district or for the whole school board or for the whole administration or anything like that, has suggested a 5-year moratorium on implementing standards. So my first question, which I'm a little surprised about, I'm glad you clarified that, Mr. Chairman, is that that would take legislative action if we were to delay any of these standards in the next 5 years.
Ms. Bobby.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
And then if you had to rework this schedule that you have right here, what would you, based on some of the concerns of school districts with tight resources, how could you suggest reworking this implementation schedule?
Ms. Bobby.
Mr. Chair, Representative, without having studied this issue a whole lot, and I would not recommend a change to the revision schedule. We still run into school districts who seem surprised that there are new standards and how are we going to mobilize and get the resources. There are other districts who follow this standards development process early on. They know the first draft, they see the second draft, they analyze the third draft, they send us their feedback. So that's a problem as well, making sure that school districts follow the process. The districts that follow the process quite closely, they still have resource problems, but they're prepared. They're preparing along the way as to how they're going to change or supplement their materials. There certainly is a downside to delaying implementation of standards because the whole reason, you know, that we do this is so that our students have up-to-date kinds of knowledge and skills that they need for future success. And I think now more than any time, we need to be very, very serious about this so that they can compete in this kind of economic climate.
Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with you totally. And yet, on the other hand, our school districts are feeling extremely pressured financially and emotionally, if that's a possibility. So I know that there are, just from listening in very many other education discussions, I know that there is talk of how can we relieve some of the financial pain of implementing new standards continually. So I would suggest to the department that you would take a look at this schedule and just say what would be the least harmful revision to this schedule to the students. And so that would just be my recommendation.
That seems fair enough. And members, there is indeed, I think, a healthy tension, frankly, in this area. You know, it seems to me that, you know, one of the realities that I think we struggle with, and not just here in K-12, is just the incredibly rapidly changing nature of our society, of our economy, and what's required in order to be successful in a rapidly changing society and economy. And I think the standards revision cycle, I suspect, were partly developed with that in mind, to not allow our K-12 delivery system become so static that then at some point trying to catch up with those needs becomes almost an impossibility. Representative Kath, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo what Representative Dietrich had said, and I would add to that, I think a suggestion for the Department of Education is to say, look at how you are training your teachers in the process, and once those standards are developed, and look at some alternative forms of curriculum, whether it be online resources, very economical resources that are available that could then supplement current curriculum that would be more cost-effective for those districts, especially during these lean times like this.
And I think that's also fair, and perhaps a little bit later at some point we'll also hear about some of the work the department is doing in this regard. Representative Newton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the review of the standards, do you complete the review in the same year? In other words, your next review is 15-16. Would you anticipate completing it during that time?
Ms. Fox.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. The reviews generally take 8 to 12 months.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair,
Representative.
Also, would you have the same time delay of 3 years before it's implemented?
Ms. Bonney.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. The exception to that was, well, yes, for all the upcoming subjects.
Mm-hmm. Good. If I can just comment,
sure, Representative.
Chair, I think, you know, coming from the same district as Mr. Hazler and Ms. Dietrich, we, as long as we have time to prepare and to do review our curriculum and to get that ready, we automatically do a 7 or 8 year review on all of our subject areas. And at that time, we would go through the books, look at new textbooks and that sort of thing. I think the big question that we have for the district is that we don't do a massive change in standards, that we, you know, get a standard, stick with it, tweak that as we go along. I think that's the most important thing, at least for our district.
Thank you, Representative Newton. Ms. Audie, I'm sure you're hearing some familiar concerns, and I think there's some good advice here for the department's consideration, and look forward to us and the department continue to wrangle over this issue of, you know, the appropriateness of the revision cycles, the length, what do we need to do to make sure that districts are well supported so that we're not just going through an exercise, but in fact, you know, full effective implementation. Why don't you continue with your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are some key revisions that have happened in the standards and will happen in the standards. And particularly, we want to focus on mathematics and science in that regard. In terms of mathematics, the newly revised standards need to reflect the legislative requirements for graduation that were enacted. First of all, students will need to complete Algebra 1 by the end of 8th grade, and that's effective for this year's 6th graders. Secondly, the students must complete Algebra 2 or its equivalent for the same class, this year's 6th graders, the graduating class of 2014-15. And then finally, the grade 11 math test must include Algebra 2 test items. Those items aligned with standards. So those are some big changes in mathematics.
Ms. Tommy, I'm going to rush you along a little bit. I do apologize. But.
Okay. I'm not going to go through each of these bullets then, but these are some major features of the changes to the MAS standards from the 2003 standards. The big changes in terms of science include these points that you see on this slide, new requirements of students needing to complete a chemistry or physics requirement credit, in addition to the biology credit that they need to complete. So we need to write standards now that include physics and chemistry, depending on which choice the student makes. You also have a statute that says half of a credit of economics can be taught in social studies, agriculture education, or business department. So this affects how agriculture education and other related areas play out in terms of delivering science standards. And finally, there's a requirement that a CTE course, a career and technical education course, may fulfill a science, math, or arts credit in addition to the other kinds of specified content. So basically what this means is that a science standard isn't necessarily delivered just in a science department course. Finally, we have a standards revision process that includes multiple stages of public input and drafting and redrafting. The standards revision process that we use in Minnesota has largely been improved through our participation in the American Diploma Project. So you can see from this process that there's a variety of different stages involved, and I won't go through all of these. But suffice it to say, we generally have a committee appointed by the commissioner. The public are invited to apply online. The commissioner picks a committee of approximately 25 to 40 people. They provide direction for how the standards will be changed. And then a smaller group known as the technical writing team, which is actually a subset of that committee, it's people on the committee, they get together and they make wording changes. They give it back to the full committee and for their feedback and so on. And at certain points, we take it out to the public to get their feedback online through town meetings held around the state and through meetings with the commissioner. So it's quite an extensive process. Here are some examples of how the department and school districts are working together to implement standards. I won't get into what all of those are. And then finally, this is a chart of standards and assessments. You'll see in red there what is required legislatively in terms of our calendar for standards revision and testing. And then you see in black the items involved in development of tests to meet those legislatively required dates. So that, in a very quick nutshell, is the standards revision process and why we have standards in our state.
Ms. Bonney, I do apologize for rushing you through. And the slide before this, I think, partly speaks to Representative Katz's inquiry around teacher training, and that has to do with the math and science teacher academies. We won't have time today to get into this. We're going to come back to some teacher development discussions, but I think one of the questions in my mind is whether or not, as supportive as I have been of those regional teacher centers, whether or not that deep enough, good enough, broad enough, are we reaching quickly enough into our teaching core in Minnesota to be able to very quickly, effectively distribute alignment of teacher practice and knowledge with our new standards. So that goes back to that bigger issue about making sure that whatever we're doing connects with the ability of those out in the field to implement those practices effectively. And so I look forward to that future discussion with you and your colleagues. Thank you. I know there's a number of questions, members, but we do have a number of people, so I'm going to push forward. And you're all very good. I suspect you'll find a way to kind of finagle those questions into our future questions. I encourage you to be creative that way. I'm going to ask Ms. Michelle Walker, Chief Accountability Officer in St. Paul, to come forward. Welcome, Ms. Walker. It's good to see you again. It's good to have you here in the committee. And, of course, if you can state your name for the record as a way to begin, and we look forward to hearing your perspective from a school district's perspective, from an accountability officer's perspective in terms of our state standards and assessments efforts and what that means in a district like St. Paul. So welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Mariani and members of the K-12 Education Committee. As was said, my name is Michelle Walker, and I am the Chief Accountability Officer for St. Paul Public Schools. I'm actually joined by Evelyn Belton-Core, who is our new Director of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment.
Well, welcome to you, Ms. Belton-Core.
I will actually submit my statement for the record through the chair for the committee, but I will read some remarks here today.
Wonderful. And we'll distribute that then for members as well. Then. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today on how state and federal standards and assessment requirements affect the delivery of instruction in St. Paul Public Schools. And before I begin, I actually want to acknowledge the wisdom of the committee for the way it has framed this question. In the era of accountability, we often miss the point of academic standards and assessment. Indeed, what gets measured gets done, but how and to what end? The true value of standards and assessment is not being able to label a particular student or groups of students as X or Y. Rather, it's the fact and the manner in which these requirements, the standards and assessments, are used to improve instructional practices that make them meaningful. And I'll come back to that point later in my remarks. The St. Paul Public Schools has long embraced academic standards and assessments and have used both to improve instruction and increase accountability for many years. For example, since 1985, we've reported district-wide test results disaggregated by race and income level to draw attention to achievement gaps and diverse needs within the district. Our district was also one of the first in the state to employ a system of competency testing for high school graduation, actually several years before statewide implementation of the basic skills test. Our schools have been required to submit database school improvement plans annually for over 20 years. So thus, way before No Child Left Behind, our district has acknowledged the need for our system to be more accountable to the public for improving achievement for all students, and we continue to do so. Accountability includes clear expectations, standards, and benchmarks, and multiple measures of progress. I have spoken before this committee on this issue of multiple measures previously. And state assessments play an important role in accountability system, but many other components also must be used. Our district has accepted the federal requirements for standards, assessment, and accountability as a starting point in how we determine whether our students in our schools are achieving. But the requirements of No Child Left Behind and Minnesota's approach to implementing the law do not paint a full picture of what happens in our schools or districts every day. In no way should AYP be the final or only determinant of quality, need, or progress, yet AYP cannot and should not be ignored. As you may already know, St. Paul Public Schools is further along the spectrum of federal sanctions for some of our schools than most other districts. And for the past 2 years, our district has implemented a series of program changes in a number of our schools. In some cases, the NCLB sanctions required for a particular school actually acted as a catalyst for these changes, but AYP, again, was only one of the factors considered. In other cases, our district relied on other data to determine whether or not a school needed to make significant changes in programming, sometimes even preceding the AYP sanctions by multiple years. Our school district has a variety of assessments that we use, national, state, and local assessments. And they're used not only for accountability at the district and school level, but more specifically to inform what occurs in the classroom. Currently, we administer or participate in more than 25 different assessments, including 7 required state tests, 16 diagnostic, benchmark, or formative assessments, 1 national assessment, and even an international assessment. We talked about TIMS just a few weeks ago statewide. And each of these provide different levels of information about student performance. We believe that the type of data that best informs instruction is formative assessment data. However, we do use data from many sources mentioned above to help us with instructional planning. And I'll just talk about a few examples. Currently, as you know, we have BST and GRAD data that we get for our high school students. Our rosters with the results of those examinations are uploaded into our data system, and we use them to identify which students need additional support to help them pass the examination. I think at our last account, we had near 1,000 students who still needed to pass either the BST or GRAD before completing high school. And the support that we provide may include enrolling any of these students in a special BST or GRAD preparation class offered by the school, tutoring, or even double scheduling. So we've used those results to look at how we actually structure the day in the school building.
Ms. Walker, let me just interject quickly. I apologize for that. But maybe if you just very quickly, for the committee's sake, and actually for my sake, because I don't always retain knowledge well enough,
sure.
But formative assessment.
Sure.
Very quickly, what are we talking about?
The term formative is used in many different ways, but typically formative is an assessment that you can use typically for us in the classroom, and it gives you data to sort of change your practices. Summative are your more standardized tests like the MCAs, the BST. They come at the end of a period, and they usually give you information about a longer period of time that the students would have encountered, information or schooling. So for us, when we categorize our summative exams, it's the state assessments, it's the even some of our national assessments like AP exams or other exams that usually come once a year, and they give an assessment of a child's exposure to instruction. Our formative assessments, the 16 that we talked about, are more like your PALs, which are shorter periods of time. They give you immediate information on literacy, and then the teacher can use that to actually inform their instruction right away. So you don't wait 12 months to get the information.
Well, therefore, what are the tensions that exist here across the nation under the NCLB framework? It is a heavy dominance of summative assessment methodology, which may or may not, if it just stands alone, be helpful for classroom instruction, at least is the argument I'm hearing from a lot of practitioners in districts.
And for us, the way that we use our summative assessments, we do use our MCA data to sort of help us determine what kind of support students need. But in our district, we talk about the shelf life that MCA data has. Pretty much after 6 to 8 weeks after the school year starts, you need to be looking at different information. So.
Thank you. I apologize again for interjecting. We'll have about 7 minutes left, I think, for you. So please continue.
We also use our higher education enrollment data to identify the needs of our students for improving post-secondary enrollment. So, for example, we'll use the Explore and Plan examinations, Explore at 8th grade, Plan at 10th grade, to actually determine what kind of supports we need to provide for our schools, counselors, and teachers to get students prepared for college. And we've also instituted a variety of those kind of support programs. AVID is one of them that we're using in our district and that we hope to expand. One of the goals of the strategic plan in our district is for all of our students to be reading by grade 3. And in order to support our schools and our families toward this goal, we have begun district-wide implementation of PALS, which is an examination that looks at literacy skills. And we use that. It is a formative and benchmark assessment that we use to help us provide the professional development to our administrators to do real-time changes for academics and literacy. Our MCA and AYP data is used to help us identify gaps and to identify the schools that require the most attention. But once we know the schools and the groups that need the most attention, we actually have to rely on other sources of data, such as attendance data or even school-based formative assessments, to monitor progress. and to provide guidance to our teachers. As I've mentioned in previous hearings, we use apples-to-apples comparisons in our district so that we could look at students compared to their peers statewide. We look at students who have the same ethnicity, free and reduced lunch status, English language learner status, and special education status across the state to see how we are comparing. And we also look at student growth, which I've spoken to this committee about as well. So indeed, there is much testing going on in our district, and we continue to work to streamline this as much as possible, because it's often difficult for our teachers and our administrators to prioritize within the sea of information. And there's sometimes confusion and misuse of data for accountability purposes and instructional purposes. So our struggle to bridge the gap between accountability and instruction actually demanded that we expand our definition of accountability and ensure that it integrated not just the assessment components, but also other indicators. And our goal was to cover the macro as well as the micro levels of our work. So this past year, we launched the Shared Accountability Framework that helps us prioritize and focus on what is most important to us as a district. Instructional improvement is certainly essential, but our framework doesn't assume that that responsibility rests solely on the schools. Our work focuses on what is certainly within our direct control as a district, but we also highlight the responsibility of all of our stakeholders, including teachers, non-teaching staff, the administration, central administration, even parents, guardians, and the community. For us, accountability is goal-oriented, it's not compliance-based. And we will certainly continue to meet our obligation under federal legislation, but MCLB is not enough. In order to ensure that high academic achievement for all of our students is occurring, we have laid out in our strategic plan a set of measurable outcomes and achievement targets that actually raise the bar above what's required by the state or the federal departments of education. In our shared accountability framework, we look at the school's AYP status as well as district targets such as attendance, growth, graduation rates, apples to apples, as I mentioned, and even down to each of those disaggregated by student groups. Our plan is not just about sanctions, which sometimes is confusing for our schools because it, with AYP, brings a set of sanctions. So we wanted to really show schools that it's not just about those sanctions, but based on where you stand, we will have to provide incentives, support, and interventions to assist our schools. Our framework is a way of helping families and schools make sense of what all these various measures mean, to help them paint a clearer picture of where they are, where they need to be, and how we will help them achieve those goals. And so to underscore my earlier point, we've attempted to be very strategic about the how and to what end of assessment and standards. And we use the data that we derive, that's derived from the federal and state required assessments, as well as the locally adopted ones, to really paint that picture. We certainly remain committed to our primary goal, which is to transform what goes on in the classroom so that we can produce the greatest outcomes for our students and ensure that every child reaches his or her potential. So I thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I know there may be questions. Both myself and Evelyn are here to respond to any specifics around what we've mentioned. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you for a very concise presentation. And I'm mindful as I was listening to it that we were hearing from the experience of a large urban school district, albeit obviously by definition, you know, dealing with relating to incredible diversity of student issues, which is growing throughout the state as well. But I was thinking about, you know, so what about those small school districts around the state, you know, where attempting to do this kind of alignment, you know, this sort of strategic work and, you know, obviously dealing with the compliance issues, but then also, you know, setting, you know, goals that make sense, you know, for those school districts. It raises questions for me about, you know, capacity issues and support issues, you know, for those small school districts, and perhaps some of our members here have some experiences with that as they represent some of our smaller school districts. Representative Dietrich, have you found a creative way to to fasten your question into a question for these two wonderful professionals. I'm just giving you an opportunity here.
No, Mr. Chairman, that's fine. Thank you.
any thoughts or questions for Ms. Walker or Ms. Boutancourt? Ms. Boutancourt, is there anything you wish to add to?
Ms. Walker's covered it very well. The only other issue that we are struggling with is the balance between over-testing our kids and having time to actually deliver instruction. It's not just the state and federal measures, but the measures we're trying to put in place, like the plan, the Explore, the PALS. We do have to have time to teach.
I suspect we have members who share that sense in their hearings from their district. Representative Loom.
I thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank the presenters for their information. Just a question along those lines. Could you comment on how much academic time is being used for testing? And I don't know if this is a fair question, but from all of the data that you collect to help you, is there one particular test or a stream of testing that you find particularly helpful for your teachers?
Great question. Ms. Boutancourt?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think that we can actually quantify the academic time. I know for our summative assessments, the state assessment, there's a period of time blocked out every year that we're required, a window of time that we're required to do those assessments. On the formative end, we're hoping that teachers are using that and incorporating it into their classroom on an ongoing basis, and that it's actually part of the instruction and not a separate standalone, but we haven't actually looked at that particular issue. With respect to what's most helpful, that is the struggle that we're engaged in all the time. And to address the chair's issue around capacity, we're fortunate in a district like St. Paul Public Schools to have an REA department, to have the capacity to assist schools with this. Because if you think about it, even as we have this department, our efforts right now are to rein in all of the different formative assessments that we're using. We have schools at each grade level using different tests. And certainly we want it to be a part of the academic day, part of instruction, but it's hard to provide consistent support if everyone's using a different measure. So we have to take the extra step to say, okay, these assessments are alike in this way. These will give you this kind of information. These will give you others. But it's because we have the capacity, limited as it is, to be able to do that and to assist our schools. I don't know if Evelyn had anything to say about the time.
We haven't quantified the time. There are periods where there's very little going on other than testing, either because we have to suspend the day to organize the kids properly to get them down to, like, for the science test or the computer lab, or to just facilitate the scheduling so that there isn't noise going on in the building while a certain group is being tested. So directly or indirectly, pretty much the MCA period is devoted to testing. I'll just have to say that. The assessments, we haven't really taken surveys. I have talked to people about the PALS, for instance. That type of assessment, at least at the moment, the teachers that we've had the opportunity to train and have begun with it, because we're doing them in cycles or batches. Because again, in a large district, you can't just train everybody at once. We neither have the infrastructure like the support nor their location. And they find that type of an assessment pretty useful. Because again, it is real time and it gives them a cross section of information. It's not just a measure of how well a student reads, but it's properly given. It can help you identify some of the places where they're struggling. So teachers can design instruction the next day for that particular student. And that's the type that I think we're trying to find more of and rein in so we can support better.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here with us on a cold Thursday morning and for your excellent, concise presentation. And part of my thoughts are that I think that all school districts are going through an incredible amount of change and trying new things as we've entered this era of formative and summative testing attempting to meet many different expectations, and I think it's something that as policymakers we need to constantly be aware of, as righteous as those expectations are, that there are practical implications in terms of the management of our schools and our delivery of instruction. And one would hope that our local delivery systems are trying to find good comprehensive ways to, you know, put all that together effectively. But I'm also cognizant that many school districts are in many different places in terms of the capacity to do that. Thank you both for being with us today, this morning. Representative Briner, we've made you wait. This is sort of like freezing the kicker in football, you know. We'll see if she'll hit the field goal or not. And then I believe you're going to be joined by Mr. Boltman as well. So this is sort of like a two-part presentation, and I leave us in your hands in terms of how you want to move forward then. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking of freezing the kicker, I have to say that we all probably have noticed the room is a little chilly, and on Tuesday I thought it was even chillier, and I spoke with our page, Emily, about the possibility of building a fire, but she told me that she thought she would rather retain her job than heat the committee up. So we just have to deal with the cold, and if I'm shivering a little, maybe it's nerves and maybe it's the temperature. But, I would say that waiting on this piece of the presentation actually probably has, you know, been provident in a certain manner. I think we've gotten a broader context for the entire discussion of how a growth model fits into the whole picture of accountability, both from a federal and a state perspective, and certainly our able research staff, Lisa Larson, has given us that context both on Tuesday and today through her background information. And I did include in your materials another document that Lisa created on measures of student learning and school accountability that gives some background to the growth model discussion. So I'm not going to talk about that now, but it's for your reading and further background. And I'll just say I'm going to be very brief today because I want to allow Mr. Boltman time to go through the growth model itself. And we have another guest today, and I'm around, so I'm available to speak to any of you on the growth model question at any time. So feel free to jot your questions down, and we can have tea sometime and, you know, elucidate the discussion further. But you do have a PowerPoint that I included in your materials, and I'm just, if I had to, we're not going to go through the whole thing. If I had to tell you what to focus on, it would be the first and last page of that. You'll see, my name is on it. It's Minnesota State Growth Model Proposal, Kathy Briner. If you're looking at, that's what I'm going to be talking from. Okay, you can see that document. This document was prepared with the able help of Christina Gossett, our committee administrator, for a presentation that I did before the Minnesota School Board Association to their delegate assembly when they're preparing their legislative agenda for this year. But I'm going to, I think also that Michelle Walker really did an excellent job of setting the stage for the issues around why measure growth. You heard her speak to the need for an apples-to-apples comparison, and those of you who've been around education quite a bit have probably heard that discussion in your own district for a while now. Since No Child Left Behind has come into place, we've talked about the apples-to-oranges aspect of the AYP measure. What's at issue there is that the AYP measure is based on comparing this year's third graders to last year's third graders, as opposed to following students over time and seeing the progress of that group of students. And the critical question there when you're talking about school performance is, what do we learn about school performance from a static measure, from the measure of proficiency, versus a dynamic measure, the measure of growth over time? So one main reason for a growth measure is the apples-to-apples comparison. And you can, I've given you a few bullet points there, following the same students. It complements proficiency. There's no issue about replacing a proficiency measure. It's not, growth measure is not in competition with the standards measure. They're meant to be complementary. They give us a different view of both our students' progress and our school's performance. The second major bullet point is identify effective practice in Minnesota. And in the context of some further discussion we'll be having around the achievement gap, I don't think we'll get to this point today, but what I would challenge you as legislators to do is become familiar with the growth model and dialogue with your own school districts about its application, because I think as a measure, it may have the greatest capacity for elucidating and addressing the achievement gap of any measure we have yet to date. Why do I say that? Because if you're looking at growth, the growth measure will allow us to identify, as we disaggregate the data, what schools are doing a particularly great job with certain groups of students. We haven't seen before. You know, this school may, with its, third grade Asian reading students, may see a tremendous leap in score that we, because we weren't looking at growth before, did not recognize. We were only looking at achievement. We see that growth, and we can say, what's going on in that school? What are the practices? So it will help us to identify best practices and then generalize those across to other schools who are having more difficulty in third grade reading with their Asian, subgroup. So that's the one motive, is to identify best practice to address areas of need with students, but also on the other end of the spectrum is our gifted and talented students. Within a proficiency model, if you reach the bar, you reach the bar, and we don't look past that. Are those students still growing? Are they growing at a level that we think is appropriate for the challenges? I mean, are we maximizing their talent? And if it's in a growth measure that we can begin to see what their achievement is. We don't see that on a strictly AYP proficiency measure. So those are the reasons for a growth measure, and my 10 minutes is going to go too fast. The middle part of this PowerPoint is essentially the history of the legislation that we've tracked over the last 2 years to move toward a growth model. We actually have a growth model, which I, even though we didn't pass our legislation, I would say is a high achievement. We got to at least a portion of the goal of that legislation. The legislation itself grew out of the issue of multiple measures, and we're going to hear more about that today. We heard some about it from Michelle Walker, and that issue is, in looking at school performance, what is it that will give us a full and fair picture of how our schools are performing? And the assumption of a piece of legislation we passed in 2007, which was to remove the 5 stars from the report card, was that AYP data alone did not give us a full and fair picture of school performance. Many, many school districts across the state had the kind of circumstance where they would have a school with a rated 2 stars and rated 5 stars. If you look at their full body of data, their data pictures were almost identical. And yet, in that ranking system, it looked like they were miles apart. So we removed the 5 stars with the goal of looking at what measures would fully, fairly, and accurately both report student achievement and school performance. We produced a piece of legislation to address that. We went through a whole process with public hearings. We took testimony from over 24 different groups, and out of that, with the help of the University of Minnesota looking at our testimony, 3 measures moved forward. One was a growth model. One was rigorous course completion, and the last one was student engagement. But now we're going to talk just briefly further about the growth model, and I'm going to let Mr. Boltman show you the model, because now we're able to do, I'm going to go right to the last page and say, what can we learn? I've kind of given you a little bit of this already. Gain a fuller picture of school performance, highlight and replicate what's working in Minnesota schools, ensure that students achieving at all levels of proficiency make accelerated growth. We've differentiated the growth into low, medium, and high, and that model has been both part of the legislative proposal and the result of a dialogue, hard work on the department's part with a group. I neglected to, you'll see in the middle of this document, mention of a group called MAG, the Minnesota Assessment Group, and I'm going to mention them because they have contributed beyond measure in terms of the time and intellectual commitment, energy, and the value that we have received both as a legislature, and I know they've worked very much with the department, and we've worked across I'd say, sort of a three-legged stool there in producing the growth model we currently have now on the department's website. But that group is a group of professionals at all levels with probably the highest expertise in the state on assessment, both at the K-12 and post-secondary level, and they've consulted with us through this entire process. So I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Boltman, and I'll be available for discussion, and let's take a look at this growth model.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Brainerd. You know what I'm going to do, because we have 15 minutes left, I'm going to call my good friend Sal to come down and sit next to you all so that we can do just a very quick transfer of, you know, to get to that last item. And obviously, Mr. Boltman, that means like I'm putting a lot of pressure on you, and I apologize for that, but... welcome to the committee. Look forward to your presentation this morning.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Tom Boltman. I'm a supervisor in the Division of Research and Assessment. I'm going to go through a very brief PowerPoint, giving a little overview of the model, and then I'll show you what it actually looks like. The Minnesota Growth Model was developed to provide a picture of how our schools and districts are helping kids grow in their mastery of Minnesota's academic standards. It's meant to provide educators, parents, and community members with detailed information on growth for schools and districts, including grade and subgroup data within schools and districts. It's also being used to provide educators with additional detailed information on growth in their schools and districts so that they can do additional analysis beyond which the analysis that is currently on the school report card. Overall, the goals are to provide a measure that is complementary to the current status measures, as well as in particular to identify areas of strength. And in a particular way, the schools that are helping non-proficient students grow at an accelerated rate. And as Representative Reiner clearly pointed out, it was an effort on many people's parts. And it wouldn't be the model that it is today if we had not had the input from experts and stakeholders throughout the state contributing. The model responds primarily to two questions. How well did we do helping non-proficient students grow towards proficiency? And how well did we do keeping helping proficient students continue to grow? To define growth, what we did is we took groups of students that are alike. And alike meant they scored like the other group of students at the prior year. So they got the same scale score on our MCA2 assessment in the prior year. Then we looked at how that group of students performed on the assessment in the subsequent year. So how did the group of grade 3 students perform when they reached grade 4? And based on the observed performance of those students, we were able to categorize them into three groups. The high category are those who score much higher than their peers this year than would be expected based on the average performance of the group. The medium group is the group that performs about as well as their peers. And the low category are those who score significantly lower than their peers. Comparing students to the actual observed growth that we are seeing in our schools, make sure that the targets are fair. The other components that we were concerned about, as at least I'll speak on behalf of the department, was making sure that when we were looking at the growth, that we're talking about growth towards academic, towards our academic standards. When we were saying high growth, that we really meant that these are the students that will be proficient in the future. And what we found is that although we didn't force that rule into the establishment of the target, that when we looked at the target, if you look at a student who scores at a very low level in grade 3 but makes the high growth target year after year, they are students who will reach proficiency during their time in our school. Likewise, the student who is currently proficient makes the low growth target. If they continue to make that kind of growth year after year, they're very likely to lose their proficient status over the course of their time in our school. So while I lost the train of thought. Making sure that the standards are reflected was not, is in a sense, forced into the establishment of the targets. The targets indeed do reinforce the standards that we have in our state. This is just a quick example in your PowerPoint of what the growth tables look like, but rather than do that, I'm going to switch over to the actual school report card here and show you what things look like. This is the Minnesota Department of Education homepage, and over on the right here is where the school report card link is. And on this page, there's an alphabetical listing of schools and districts. I'm going to click here right now and go to the accountability information for the entire state rather than pick a particular school or district. And what you see on the landing page is Minnesota's growth model. The plan right now is that we'll rotate what measure is the primary measure that's being displayed depending on what kind of essentially what season we're in, what the current piece is that we roll out. Because growth is something that we were just rolled out as of December, that's currently the main focus on the home page. And what you see is a little bit of explanatory text that sort of reiterates what I just talked about in the PowerPoint. And then the two charts for our statewide levels in math and reading. You can pick the link and break it down by grade so that instead of looking at the all students in math, you can look at all students plus the students in grade 4, grade 5, grade 6, etc. You can also break that down then by subgroup. And I'll just pick grade 4 math just as an example and show that you can then see how our students are doing in the various subgroups at that particular grade level. Subgroups available for all students as well. And then beyond what's on the school report card, there's additional resources available to educators inside of our secure application educator portal. Educators can get access to a detailed report that lists out they can see all the same information that's on the school report card, but they can also get this detailed report that lists the exact information that we use to calculate the model at the student level so that if they want to replicate any of this to confirm that they understand how we calculated the measures that we did, or even better, if they want to take the information and extend it, if they want to say, all right, we're seeing a particular pattern in grade 4, but now we want to look at it for students who are enrolled in a particular program in grade 4 and see if the pattern holds to help explore what maybe are some of those best practices that are going on, or maybe some areas of concern. And in the interest of time, I think I'll end my comments.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Boltman. Very well done, and very well done on the part of the department. Of course, the holy grail, it seems to me, in this whole effort is that latter point, the ability of colleagues across our K-12 system, hopefully guided and facilitated by our Department of Education, to be able to zero in on learning environments that are similar, but where you're showing some very interesting good growth happening to then identify what's being used in that particular setting that could be emulated and borrowed and used by others. I'm going to jump over to Sal Kaur, my good friend. Sal, I've known you for a long time. It's good to have you here. We're going to have you talk very quickly about this concept of multiple measures. We just looked at one measure here in terms of the growth model, in addition to our sort of dominant summative dominated measurement system. We also heard about different types of formative testing. But you're going to talk about some other ways in which we can measure and think about and learn about what's happening in our schools.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to provide a glimpse of the data that we use in Edina as we work to ensure accountability and high-quality learning for every student. First, let me be clear that we believe that the bottom line is indeed student academic learning. But at the same time, we recognize that when employers or ask what skills are important, academic learning is only one of many. Additionally, we know from the research on the brain and learning that when the brain shifts down, little learning will occur. As a result, we use a variety of measures to assess academic learning and to assess the factors that promote an environment that will support the high levels of academic learning that we desire. I provided you a handout today of looks like a matrix and has Edina Public Schools up in the corner. This is a sample out of our success measures document. This happens to be, as you can see, strategic direction number 2. Working with a local consultant, Teamworks International, we've identified 6 strategic directions to guide our work in the district. And by the way, strategic direction number 1 is to maximize student achievement for every student. Annually, we survey students in grades 1 through 12, staff, and parents. On the handout, you see on the front page that success measures 2A and 2B both use data from those surveys as a measurement. notice that in 2C, we're using the data from the state-supported Minnesota Student Survey. Our student surveys have always included some questions to gauge student engagement. We know that if we do not provide an environment that engages students in learning, then learning quality will suffer, perhaps to the point of students dropping out. This past year at grades 9 and 11, we substituted the nationally available High School Student Survey of Student Engagement, or HESI, as it is commonly known, for our local student survey. And in item 2D, you can see that we use that measure as our measure of success. The other three pages in the handout are not provided to show you how one of our schools compared to the nation, but rather at the bottom of each of those, or actually at the top as well, you see the three dimensions, the three major dimensions of student engagement that HESI identifies: cognitive, intellectual, academic, social, behavioral, participatory, and emotional. These various survey measures that we use are not used just for measuring our success toward our strategic direction. As schools develop their annual school improvement plans, they examine the survey data and frequently identify one or more environmental variables for attention. While we've used our local surveys in HESI, we also know that the Check and Connect project at the University of Minnesota has developed a student engagement measure that might well be used should the state decide to implement a student engagement assessment statewide. The Minnesota-based Search Institute has conducted nationwide research that consistently shows that the more assets young people have, the less likely they are to engage in a wide range of high-risk behaviors, and the more likely they are to thrive. We actively partner with our community in an initiative called Connecting with Kids. Connecting with Kids periodically administers the Search Asset Survey and then works to further develop these assets in our young people. Because of the federal demands to determine whether students are proficient, state assessments must be designed to maximize the precision of measurement at the scores around that criterion score. That is the score that separates the proficient students from the not proficient students. As a result, state assessments do not provide districts with high quality information about students at either end of the score continuum. If we are to personalize learning for each student, we believe that we need high quality data across the entire continuum, so we continue to administer a nationally norm reference test. In our case in Edina, it's the Measures of Academic Progress, or MAP, which is used by many other Minnesota districts. Due to our time constraints, I'll not detail how we use this information, except to highlight one new initiative. At one of our elementary schools, we began a pilot this year to alter the content of the parent-teacher conference in grades 3 through 5. In this pilot, the parent and teacher focused on the student's growth on the MAP and on goal setting designed to maintain or accelerate the student's growth. Initial feedback from parents has indicated that they saw this as a much more focused and productive conference than the older, more traditional structure. As we and other districts move to implement RTI, Response to Intervention, we are adding additional measures that allow us to measure student learning progress on a weekly or biweekly basis. In our case, we've adopted a commercially available system known as YPT, Yearly Progress Monitoring. Additionally, along with many other districts in the state, we're exploring common district assessments, especially at the high school level. Often these are known as end-of-course exams, but with a different purpose and focus from that which we have advocated as a replacement for the grad. A number of states have supported districts by providing a set of common district assessments that are aligned with their state standards. I will not debate the value of the No Child Left Behind standards and assessments. They are required. As such, it's important that as Minnesota moves forward to develop the next generation of standards and assessments, they be of the finest quality. As we explore the implementation of multiple measures, it's important that adequate funding be provided so that we do not divert funds from the current task developing these high-quality standards and assessments. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'll be pleased to entertain any questions you might have.
I think we have time for one question. Let's go to McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I applaud what you're doing. I think a lot of school districts are doing the same thing. My question is, are you doing and keeping this data internally to for your continuous improvement, and do you share this information on your website?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do keep it internally. You know, as mentioned by St. Paul, we also have extensive student database where we keep data as well as produce many reports to assist schools as they do their school improvement planning. We do make quite a good variety of it available on the website, not continually. You know, the success measures, for instance, that I gave the example of, we're in our first year of implementation of those. We shared data with the board in a public meeting, but that is not currently on the website, but it has gone public in beyond that sense.
Thank you, Mr. Corn. Thank you for the example that translates all this into very practical, immediate practices that I think resonate with the values that were expressed around the table here as well. I apologize that we could use much more time just having a deeper discussion. I apologize to the members. I should have planned this a little bit differently, perhaps, with, you know, not trying to do so much, but I think we've got some very good initial quality information. Mr. Bowman, thank you for your presentation. Members, do visit the website and play with it a little bit and come back with some thoughts in that regard. Members, we will not meet on Tuesday morning. We are scheduled to meet on Wednesday morning. So I'll see you all then. This meeting is adjourned. Until then, the meeting stands adjourned.